This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will December 2025 CME E-mini S&P index futures settle above 6,200 on September 30th, 2025? Well, the yes forecast contract recently traded at 80% and the no was at 17%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change, the economy, or even politics. You choose yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore the data, spot the trends, and make your prediction for December 2025. Trade forecast contracts in Interactive Brokers and earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. The last day trading for this contract is September 30th.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Big tech on the move again. Economic reports show some mixed reports. And we're challenging the highs again. Our guest today is Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 937 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, it's Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to The Disciplined Investor. This is now squarely in September 2025, and here we are challenging some of the highs once again and getting some, I would say, slight volatility. Started out a little bit wonky, moved around for the week, and of course we have those economic numbers that we have something to talk about here, obviously. But this week, what I really wanted to do is get down and dirty with our good friend Frank Curzio, because Frank and I, when we talk, we cover just an incredible amount of ground. We talk about anything from economics to the Fed to earnings to even crypto. And I know that some of the topics that we're going to have, because I wrote them down, things that I want to bring up in our conversation today. So without going into all the different things that we have and some of the concepts that we usually talk about at the front of this episode, we're going to get right down into our discussion with Frank. And Frank Curzio, of course, is from Curzio Research. He's a great writer, researcher, and been around a long time doing this. So let's get right to that discussion. And our guest today is Frank Curzio. This is a cold open. If you haven't noticed, you know, they do this on Saturday Night Live, Frank, where they just kind of come right in. And we're coming right in because there's so much to talk about. Frank, how are you?
I'm doing good. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. So we're gonna hit on a lot of topics today because I want to spend time with you, and that's why I'm not kind of going through the whole regular opening and what we do usually at length of the kind of monologue part of it. I want to start off with some economic, and then I want to go into some valuations. I want to talk about some specific stocks. I want to talk about small caps. But, and there's a lot of things in between that I have all these notes written down here. Let's talk about eco for a second. Let me set the stage for you. Global U.S. economics, interesting that the consumer continues to be, I would say, semi-resilient in the United States. Employment numbers, a little up, a little down. 1 month doesn't make a difference here or there. But generally speaking, you know, not terrible. Manufacturing still in a little bit of a contraction. Services still holding up really well. Beige Book talked about this week that prices are still, they're a big concern about prices, that they see that there's going to be escalation in prices coming, and that a lot of areas are still having a little bit of an issue with employment. You know, the things that we know, nothing's really changed. One of the big issues that has changed, and then I'm going to hand it over, is the uncertainty, again, of tariffs. You know, we had tariffs on. Okay, everybody was like, okay, I'm not sure where they're going to be. What's going to happen? Okay, now we know. And now all of a sudden it goes into court and it's like, hey, we're not sure what's legal, what's not legal. That may change a few things. All of this has created an environment of a lower dollar, a steady, we'll call it bond yield, generally speaking. A lot, you know, yield curve has actually been steepening. But the U.S. economy and earnings, but we'll start with the economy, has been pretty strong. How is that possible?
You know, you bring up a lot of good points, Andrew, because it's the perfect market conditions for stocks to go higher. And I'll tell you why. Because when you're looking at the data, it's tough to be an economist. We always make fun of economists because they're always wrong on predictions and stuff like that. But it's difficult to be right on predictions where we clearly have inflation going higher in the past couple of months. Clearly have inflation going higher. Job market clearly weaker, right? It doesn't matter. The last 8 or 9 jobs reports has got revised lower, the last couple significantly lower. Mm-hmm. So we see weakness here, you know, consumer spending a little bit, higher rates right now. But yet we'll look at GDP figures for next quarter. And this is from Atlanta Fed that just came out, that they're predicting after, what was it, 3.2%, I think we just grew at 3.3%.
Yep, 3.0, then they came up to 3.3 on the final or on the latest revision.
3.3. Now they're predicting they went from 2.2% for next quarter to 3.5%. And this isn't tariff related. We say, oh, everybody, you know, imports and exports and everybody's ordering really quick for a tariff going. This is by stronger demand in the U.S. of what we're seeing for services, for products. So it's not mass where you could say, okay, you know, a lot of people are buying just because of the tariffs to get ahead of it and buying products before the tariffs kick in. So the tariffs, I would say, is a lot of it's factored in. I think it's a non-event at this point because, you know, we know that Trump owns the Supreme Court and he already just filed a motion to get this on the books right away. And, you know, so it's probably going to be reversed. So we got a temporary decline last week and you know, I'm not really concerned about tariffs of that going away at all. You know, I don't think the Supreme Court, again, it's, you know, in favor of Trump and you know, that's his benefit.
Which, by the way, a little snarky reply on my part. The reason that they're so pissed off is that the highly partisan courts overturned it. So now they're going to the nonpartisan Supreme Court to see what they say.
And as an investor, you can get pissed at Trump. Yeah, you can get pissed if you're a Democrat, Republican. This is about the only thing Andrew and I care about is making you money. That's our job while you listen to this podcast, right? So for me, when I look at tariffs, it's a non-factor. That's why the markets went up a couple of days after that. It declined, I think, one day last week because of it. But when it gets to the Supreme Court, it's going to be reversed. You could hate it. You could hold up a sign. I'm just telling you that I'm not worried about that being a risk where I think a lot of people are talking about that more. And also the Fed, what's her name, who's Cook. You know,
Cook.
Yeah, Cook. You know, I mean, to me, a lot of noise because we just finished earnings. There wasn't a lot of news flow after earnings and stuff like that. But these stories I'm not really paying too close attention to. What I am paying close attention to is the massive tailwinds that are in place where we just saw. I was amazed to see that Powell pivoted. Okay. The reason is because 3 months, 4 months ago, even 3, 4, 5 months ago, even from January on through April through almost May, pretty much through April. That was your chance. Like that was your chance to pivot. Okay, we see inflation coming down, right? Employment, you know, it just made sense where inflation was crashing. Inflation was absolutely crashing from where it was. Mm-hmm. And then we saw go from 2.3, 2.4, which is closer to 2%, right? And that's what they want. Now it's 2.7%. The core is over 3%. You know, for him, after the 2 inflation reports that we just saw, we're going to get the next ones, you know, this week and going forward over the next 10 days or so, they're critical because right now the Fed's saying, I'm okay with inflation going to 3.5% and maybe approaching 4% because I'm more worried about the labor market. Regardless of what you think, it means lower rates are coming quicker and the market is trading on rates going lower quicker, right? Mm-hmm. So when you have lower rates, you have deregulation with a ton of this money on the bank's balance sheets, which doesn't need to be there because the Fed's going to bail out the banks every single day, right, of the week. So why are they holding all this capital for a 30% decline in the market, a 50% decline in housing, GDP to go negative, right? All this nonsense, unemployment 10%. Those are real numbers, by the way. You know, and then you have this America First initiative from Trump where all these manufacturing jobs coming in here, you know, continued money printing. I don't care who's in office. There's lots of tailwinds behind this market for it to go higher over the next, you know, 6, 12, 18 months.
Not to mention that this administration is market friendly. Not only that, they're market obsessed.
Business friendly, market friendly. They look at the stock market every day. And you know, again, politics aside, you want to hold up a sign, you want to vote against him, whatever, you want to create a super PAC to go against Trump, whatever. The bottom line is you want to be on the right side of politics, whether it's Biden in office or whether it's Trump in office. Be on the right side. We're seeing that with crypto. Look at Justin Sun. Look at CZ. Look at the Winklevoss twins. All of them. Look at what they're getting now. And then you have someone like who's T-Zero, who's basically funding for the Democratic Party and not on Trump's side, and you're not seeing anything go their way. As a business, you need to be on the right side of the politics. You focus on those companies, you're doing fantastic. I mean, look at Boeing. Look at IBM. They're traveling with the president. Look at NVIDIA. Look at AMD. They're traveling. Yes, they pull back a little bit from their highs here, but you know, you want to be part of that group because every country that he signs these tariffs with is going to open a door for, hey, we have NVIDIA right here. It's going to help you now. We have AMD to help you with your data centers. Now you can order planes from Boeing. You've seen those orders. I mean, how many orders have they gotten since in the past 4 or 5 months? It's a different company now. So you know, that's where I'm looking, where I see lots of tailwinds. Doesn't mean everything's going higher. I wouldn't say buy the entire market, but there's a lot of pockets of growth here that I really like.
Just to get back to T-Zero, I haven't heard that in a while. Was that Muriel Siebert? What company teed up with T-Zero? There was another brokerage.
It was Best Buy. It was Bed Bath & Beyond.
Oh, yes, that's right.
So now they separated, was Mark Sleonis is actually pissed at David Goon. David Goon is like he was a rock star. You know, what he's done in 30 years for you know, New York Stock Exchange and you know, created so much innovation, right, for Intercontinental. And he hasn't done crap yet, even though look at what's going on with crypto, with all the crypto companies and signing deals, pro-SEC, right? Crypto's on fire. We've been talking about crypto for how long on this podcast with you, Andrew? So, you know, we've generated amazing returns. We bought Ethereum at 180. It's 4,500. We bought Bitcoin at 6,000, right? It's 110,000. I mean, the gains that we've seen in a lot of these, and now you're going to see, you know, more and more of these. They just passed a rule. I don't know if you saw it. It's a joint between, what was it, the SEC and the Commodities Exchange, that they're saying that crypto should be allowed to trade on any exchange. And if you're looking at that news, you might say, well, I don't know if that's a big deal. I mean, it really is a big deal when you look at the total market and how big it is, because the market is absolutely massive. I mean, you're looking at the four largest firms alone account for, you know, trillions, right, in volume. Now you're creating all this. Now you look at the next 20, 30 cryptos. Anyway, I didn't want this to go into cryptos, but you want to be on the right side of politics when it comes to T-Zero. They haven't been, and you're seeing that with that platform, because we trade on that platform. You could own an equity stake in our company. We did that like 5-6 years ago. Now you're seeing Galaxy Digital do it. You trade 24/7. You know, now we might go to a different platform because we're not seeing that liquidity take place on T-Zero. But, you know, we were one of the first to do this with our company in the world. And we're seeing a lot of companies do it now where you could trade us, where you don't have to invest in private companies. Now you have an outlet where you could trade back and forth. You should be able to buy and sell those shares. And now you're going to see a lot of private companies on these exchanges that are going to be actively trading through the tokenization.
Do you think the tokenization, I understand that for some private companies raising money, getting liquidity, getting ability to transfer and transact, for a company like yours, Frank, which is a private company and small in the scheme of things of what, you know, publicly traded companies are, right? I'm not saying you're small, but you know what I mean?
It's no comparison.
But, yeah. So what are your thoughts though on tokenization of publicly traded companies? Is it necessary?
It's fascinating.
Oh, it's fascinating, but is it necessary?
Oh, it's fascinating. Is it necessary? That's a good question. Is it necessary? Well, if you're okay with the status quo, when I say status quo is, you know as well as I do, and we both hate this. I bet you a lot of people hate this. 99% of retail investors hate this. But what happens when a company reports earnings after the close or before they open? Mm-hmm. You see the stock go 5-10, it's trading. Who's trading that? Who gets in those stocks early? You have the Citadels, you have the biggest companies in the world, right? They're able to trade those pre-market, where it's very difficult for retail investors to trade pre-market. Now, if you're going on the blockchain, not only do you have quick settlement, but now you have 24/7 trading. You could trade that whenever you want. You could trade as soon as they report earnings, if that's at 4:30 p.m., 5 p.m., whoever reports, you're allowed to trade. And I think that's a fair and open market, right? And now you have, you know, decentralized exchanges as well, like Polymarket just got approved. I mean, you know, just, you know, don't want to get too broad here, but the tokenization of these stocks is coming. And Galaxy is the first one that just did it, Galaxy Digital, but allows 24/7 trading. It takes the power away from a lot of these, you know, the algos and how they trade. I mean, these are front runners, right? These systems front run the markets, and we all know it, right? They just front run the markets. They don't care about the fundamentals of a company or whatever. They're looking at trades, and based on what's going to happen and what's going to trade, they're able to get in, you know, trade these things milliseconds, generating a fortune before, you know, anyone's really buying or selling, right? I mean, these lists of securities completely change. The thousands that they own completely change on a daily basis, right? Because it's just, how do we constantly generate that really little tiny bit of penny here, penny there? But when you talk about billions and billions of trading, you know, so that's why Citadel is dead set against this and saying, hey, we don't need this. But yet,
well, they're,
it's going to provide much more liquidity, right?
Well, this is direct competition.
24/7.
This is direct competition to the Black or the gray markets, the high speed trading, the liquidity pools, et cetera.
Yeah. And tokenization is a big word. I mean, tokenization.
Well, it's, by the way, until they figure out how to get on it.
Yeah, but tokenization is this fractional ownership of an asset. And think about what you could do in the liquidity you create. Say if you have $100 million commercial real estate portfolio. Okay, retail investors can't buy that. So you have $100 million, and say you want to sell off $20 million of that asset. All right, so you could sell off $20 million to investors, and they own a piece of that asset. They have an equity stake in it. Maybe you pay them a 5%, 7% dividend while you're collecting on rents. That's a pretty good investment that a lot of people will want because a lot of retail investors don't have access to it. It's great for the retail investors. It's great for the person who owns it because now I'm getting a check for $20 million that I could put someplace else. Mm-hmm. Not only that, it's great for investors because now you go from a private company trading at 3x earnings. It's not going to trade at 22x earnings, which is an S&P multiple, but it's going to probably trade maybe about 7 or 8x, which means that $100 million portfolio, once you do this and tokenize and sell off a piece of that fractional ownership, is probably going to be $150 million. What's the downside to any party that's participating in that? And when you see that, that's how you disrupt markets. So when I see tokenization, I've always saw it as something that's remarkable, but you've always had that regulation of lobbying dollars from the big banks. I mean, you know, look, we're going to see with Circle and stablecoins, right? I mean, mm-hmm. No fees. Why are they charging us so much? Why do I get charged wiring fees? Why do banks charge me fees? They're using my money. They're generating money off it, and they charge massive fees, right? And the less you have, the more they charge. I mean, imagine eliminating all that. The credit card processing fees, you know, you go out to dinner, they're all charging you an extra 3% now. They push it on you as a consumer.
That whole thing is ridiculous, by the way. For years,
but everyone's doing it.
I know.
It's ridiculous. But why do I have to pay that? That's why you look at MasterCard and Visa getting disrupted. This is what some of these crypto companies are able to do. And that's what tokenization does as well, which is fascinating. It's happening. It's going to happen.
I've talked about blockchain ownership and tokenization, whether it's through NFTs or some other kind of tokenization, as you call it, for fractional ownership or full ownership, by the way. Mm-hmm. That resides on the blockchain with a wrapper. I said, and I've talked about this a couple of years ago, you know, what about like your house? You know, you want to sell a house. Oh my God, the ordeal, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the paperwork, you have to deal with the attorneys. You have to look at the title insurance, the title on the blocks, on the plats. You have to look at what outstanding notes there are, closing those down, opening them up. Why not just put it in your home on a, we'll call it tokenizing the home, I guess we'll call it, as one piece that could be easily transferable on the blockchain with the entire wrapper of the title insurance, of the mortgage, of the ownership, of the title, all that inside that. And that's why it was NFT, right? Because you could do that. But of some kind of a inside the token, right? Inside that digitized house. It's all there. Mm-hmm. And just pass along.
If you took out a home equity loan or HELOC, what's the interest on that? Do you know?
Probably 8%.
All right, so 8%. So say if I want to do it, I decide to sell a piece of my house and I paid 6%, right? So now if I do it at the bank, it's 8%. But now you own a piece of my house, right? And you own, and I'm paying you 6%, which isn't a bad deal because you're also going to get the appreciation if I sell that house at a higher price. Mm-hmm. You have that ownership.
Right.
That's a small scale, but now you look at what BlackRock is doing, it's much better. I mean, they buy these neighborhoods, you know, these houses, 300 houses go for $500,000 each, but they'll pay $300,000 for them. Right, by the whole neighborhood. And then there's been videos on this too. It's remarkable what they do. So they'll sell a couple of years later, three or four of those houses, $750,000. And who they sell them to? A different fund from BlackRock. This way it raises the value on it of the whole neighborhood, which they own. And now they can borrow 3-4 leverage against it. That's why they're the largest real estate owners.
That's a problem. That's what Zillow tried to do. That's what this Open Door tried to do. Zillow got out of that business.
Yeah, just like E-Trade got out of the HELOC business.
Well, right. Well, that was forced upon them.
Yes, it was. They're in a credit crisis, absolutely.
Yeah, a little forced upon.
You do things with other people's money, and it's fine. That's what sucks about banks.
Once you start stacking leverage
is
where the problems come in. Once you start creating false market values, which is an interesting topic to talk about. So let's put a pin in that, false market values, for a second. But once you start talking about that, and like, for example, a few years ago, there was a really interesting SoftBank, Masayoshi-san. He went and basically did a huge amount of far out of the money calls that he bought on stocks. Now, the sellers of those were like, okay, well, what do we got to do? Well, we got to buy the underlying stock to make sure we don't get squashed, right? Mm-hmm. So what happened was it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. There was a spike on a couple of days, one day in particular, where Apple and Google and Amazon, and pick all the names you want, were up like dramatically. Like, what is going on? Well, what happened was that you had to protect your call that you sold as a seller of the option in case you were going to get this thing run away with you on a short squeeze. And it created its own short squeeze on its own by doing so. And everybody found out because it collapsed afterwards. Then my son got screwed on the on his options. It was a whole big hoop-de-doo. But that's creating false market values, somewhat like they're doing with buying a house and then selling the house to themselves for $200,000 higher and assuming that it's going to bring up all the houses in the neighborhood.
Well, it does, right? It brings up the comp, and that's what it's valued at with the banks because you're saying, hey, there's four comps here that sold for $750,000. And, you know, now you could base the whole neighborhood on that. Now you could leverage against that much higher amount. But how old is your son? How old is your son now?
Just going to turn 30 this month.
Oh, 30. Okay. Because I was going to say, even 20-year-olds, like I remember, you know, my late dad did this forever. I was at a, you know, I used to talk to him about stocks at the dinner table when I was like, you know, probably 12, 13, 14.
Fun.
But I never really got into options when I was younger, right? I mean, it's so, the younger generation, I feel like it's such a gambling generation where, you know, it's tough lessons, but putting time values on stocks, especially, it doesn't, you could be right and your timing could be wrong and you're going to get killed. It's just amazing because, you know, most kids I see that are under, you know, 30 years old, it's all about options and you're seeing those daily options and crazy. Just, I was just curious to see because, you know,
oh, no, they're into options. No, this is a big thing. The options have definitely taken off as a really massive, quick and easy way. Now, I don't think as fanciful with the iron condors and with the, you know, various spreads and all that. I mean, they're not maybe involved in those kinds of level of options, but they're definitely involved in, if nothing else, saying, hey, you know what, why am I going to take $50,000 to pay, or whatever, $10,000, $5,000, pick your number, and invest in this stock? You know what? I think it's going to go up over the next however long. I'm gonna buy you know, $2,000 worth. I know I can lose $2,000, but you know the stock all of a sudden runs up into the money, and you made $6,000 profit. That's a 300% profit.
Yeah,
nothing wrong with that. Let's take a quick break for a second. Let's talk about Interactive Brokers, and then Frank, I want to talk to you about some of the things that are happening with rates, and I want to get back to this discussion about valuation. So stick around for a second. Sure. And I love talking about Interactive Brokers. And one of the things you need to know is that investing is about seeing the bigger picture. But sometimes the connections aren't very obvious, are they? That's why Interactive Brokers created Connections. With Connections, you can explore related stocks, ETFs, options, futures, and even forecast contracts all in one place. Discover trends, compare companies, and even uncover opportunities across 160 global markets. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers, and Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. The risk of loss in online trading of stocks and options and futures, of course, can be substantial, but I want you to learn more. I want you to go to ibkr.com/connections, ibkr.com/connections. And we're back with Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. First of all, Frank, you know, I didn't ask you about this. Two things. Do you want to tell people right now where to get your newsletters and all the great things you do? And secondly, do you want to, I don't know if you want to do this, and if maybe shut me down here, but do you want to talk about your conference coming up?
Yeah, my first ever
I wasn't sure this was available for the public, but so that's why.
Yeah, it's available. We're going to have lots of speakers. We're going to make those announcements for speakers. We've got lots of sponsors already. It's going to be a Pier 66. It's for Curzio One investors. That's our high-end membership that gets access to the private placements I invest in personally at the same exact terms that I get. You get access to all of our products and services, which is like seven of them, that we charge, you know, several thousand dollars for some of these services, which is an AI service, crypto intelligence service, you know, small cap service. So, you know, a lot of research. I do videos on these all the time. So it's, you see that.
And just to let everybody know, teaching you. Just to let everybody know, I was invited to speak there. And unfortunately, because it's literally down the block from me, not that Frank wouldn't fly me to France or somewhere else to speak, but nonetheless, it's literally down the block from my office at the Pier 66 Hotel, which is absolutely, seriously beautiful, fully redone within the last year. It is a gorgeous facility. Right on the water, on the intercoastal right there. Right in my fishing grounds. I can't be there because I have a family wedding up in Jersey.
And you're lucky because you didn't know that. There's probably going to be about 125, 150 people there. High-end investors. These are all mostly, I would say, 95% accredited investors. We probably raised over $30 million for companies through this group of investors. But I know you have a boat, and I was going to make sure you gave free boat rides. So it's probably,
you know what I'm going to do, though? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hook you up with my son, who has actually a charter service.
There you go.
Right there. No, right there. He has a beautiful 44-footer.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
That's great.
Gorgeous. It's perfect for you. Awesome. It's so high-end.
Yeah, I really wish you could make it because we always, you know, I love these podcasts with you. We've been doing this for how many years? Over 15 years now. And everybody knows you're there. It's going to be really cool. It's a good guest and stuff like that. So it would have been good to pitch your services and stuff like that because I know you're doing really well now. So
how do people get in touch with you otherwise or for this?
I would say instead of going to CurzyResearch.com, you could do that. Just listen to our podcast, Wall Street Unplugged. I've been doing it for a long time. It's an hour-long podcast. We really cover everything. It's unconventional. You know, nobody tells us what to say or to do because I have my partner, Dale Creech, on it, who's a senior research analyst here. We cover all the topics. You're going to hear different opinions because, you know, we don't have to, you know, follow anybody's lead on anything or be told to do anything. And, you know, a lot of it's contrarian. A lot of it's real. Sometimes we get passionate. You'll hear cursing and stuff like that. But, you know, it's one of the most widely listened to financial podcasts, which we're very proud of, which yours is as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it helped me build this business, right? And it's remarkable what the podcast has done. I know it helped build your business. Yep. But go there, listen. If you like it, then go to Curzio Research. Because we could sell you and have a good promotion on a very exciting stock or whatever. But instead of doing that, listen to us first. See if you like it. If you do, then go to our stuff. And then, you know, start out a low-price newsletter, which could be anywhere from like $10 a month. And, go from there. But usually people who subscribe to one of our products end up subscribing to many of our products. And then those who accredit become Curzio One because, you know, they know our research is real. We back all of our research recommendations. If we're wrong, we're going to tell you exactly what to do with it because in this business, sometimes you're going to be wrong. Yeah. We're right more than you're wrong or we wouldn't be doing what we're doing. But yeah, that's what people want to know. Should I buy more? Should I sell? Right. And we're always there for you. So it's pretty cool.
So it's also great about Frank's hour-long podcast is he speaks so fast. You actually get 2 hours worth of podcast in
you
one.
You don't have to speed it up. you don't have to put it on 1.5, right? That's so true. I know. I hear you.
Let's talk about rates.
Yeah, buddy.
So the rates, you know, this whole big thing came along that, we need rates to go down. Because of, name what it is, the housing market slowed down. It's better for businesses. It's too high. It's actually choking the economy, screwing up unemployment, blah, 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 blah. And the idea was, if nothing else, it was going to make housing more affordable, which I have a totally different opinion on. Rates down, housing prices up, but that's okay. The long rate has come up a bit. One of the things is there's some concern about the overall governance and the Fed, and the Fed now in the next year to become a arm of the government with politicized, I guess that's the right word. Is there any concern of yours about these bond vigilantes or any of this other concern about U.S. bonds having a problem that may spark a sell-off or some other concern in the U.S. economy / stock market?
Not right now. You would see it with the spreads. The bond market is a good leading indicator, right? I mean, we saw that when the carry trade, right, went bad. I mean, you see a lot of things go bonkers in the market. We saw that with tariffs. When tariffs were first announced, when Trump decided, which I thought was the most worst strategy ever, to deal with every country at the same exact time because every conversation's different. Right, and then I think Bessent tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, the bond market is really confused right now. They're telling you, you better get this straight and you better have some clarity. And all of a sudden he's like, okay, we're good with China for 3 months and we're good with this for 3 months. But the bond market was you saw the spreads, basically widen. You see a lot of confusion in that. CNBC is very good about talking about it, but it's a leading indicator to tell you, hey, something's a little broken or not working right. We saw that at the beginning of the announcement. So when it came to tariffs, you're not really seeing too much of it. We're seeing, rates supposed to come down, but the higher end's a little bit higher right now, but I think you're going to see rates come down, with the Fed lowering rates too. I mean, that's on the short end of the curve, but it doesn't bother me right now because this is something I follow and I'm not seeing any cracks in the foundation, which I normally see if you see something big that's going to happen, which is a black swan event. You saw it with the credit crisis. You saw it just recently with the carry trade. You saw it even with when it came to COVID. You're not really seeing it too much right now, so I'm not really too worried.
Right.
What about you? I mean, I'm curious to hear your opinion on that.
I'm not concerned. I'm just keeping aware of it.
Yes, exactly.
It's right now, I think the market, the environment, the investor sentiment is there's a lot of things out there that we could pinpoint either individually or combined with other things that are concerning or worrisome or, they could be, I don't know, they could be horrifying. Right. I mean, if we were to just snapshot, come out of nowhere and see what's going on in our government and our deficits and all that, be like, oh, my God, let's get out. But the fact is we've slow boiled it and here we are. So I think that investors are either one of two things. They're exhausted. They're dumb. They don't care. Or they're just giving it a buy, saying, it can only last this long. Let's see what happens. Worst comes to worst, we could always move out. And particularly, it used to be that making a decision you had to make because it could take you a long time to unwind something or get out of something, or it wasn't as easy as this. Click a button, I'm done. I mean, literally, I can sell client portfolios out with one click of a button, done. Everything's clean, and I mean, literally in less than a minute, I could clean a whole portfolio out. So, you know, I think there's something to be said about people saying, you know, I got time. I'm not too worried about it.
No, I hear you. But you see those concerns coming again, leading indicator, and right now I'm not really seeing it, so I'm not too worried about it. So.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm monitoring it.
Well, let's go into the other area. Let's go into valuations. Let's start with publicly traded companies, and let's go into the private markets. PE forward on the market cap weighted S&P 500 is somewhere around, what, 22 plus?
Mm-hmm, 22.
You know, that's historically high. The CAPE cyclically adjusted is also at a relative, it's not at the highest it's ever been, but it's high. Large caps, clearly, which everybody is making the story and the narrative that they deserve to be as expensive as they are. Okay, that's fine. I have no problem with that. You know, if they're going to make the money, if you're going to see an NVIDIA that does, you know, looking for a 50X or 50%, not 50X, 50% growth on a year over year, they could support. Well, actually, they've been doing 50% on quarter over quarter, I think. But nonetheless, if they did 50% year over year, they could support a 50, 60 PE, right? I mean, that's not a problem. They'll grow into it for a while until they can't. But there seems to be a inability for markets to go down for any reason, and valuations keep on getting higher and higher. And yes, earnings were actually really good. You look at, what do we see, 11% growth on a year-over-year basis?
And we're expecting double-digit growth next quarter for the rest of the year into 2026.
So. Right. So we can argue about valuation if we consider that the earnings growth won't continue forever. I think that's not an unreasonable thing to say, right? Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't agree with that with the short term because
not the short term. Not short term. I'm saying in long term, you have to wonder, you know, are we going to stay with these kinds of growth rates?
Well, if you describe long term, if you're looking at, you know, longer than a year or 2 years, I think we're going to see double digit growth in earnings, and we're seeing it right now. I mean, when have you seen a market, think about it, where people worried about the return on investment for AI? These companies, have you seen the numbers that they're reporting?
Oh, they're absurd.
Have you seen
the
growth?
Great.
I mean, they're generating massive returns on their AI spend right now. And you want proof of that? Look at the layoffs. I mean, there's massive layoffs taking place. When have you seen massive layoffs take place with the market at all-time highs?
Yep.
On your all-time highs. You don't see it.
Doesn't happen.
So the efficiency, the productivity gains that these companies are making are fascinating, and it's going to result in fewer jobs. You know, but...
And that's why some of the young people going into the jobs market these days are having such a difficult time because the jobs they want, those internships slash first year slash entry levels are like, no thanks. I mean, I don't know about you, but even mundane items that we use AI for are incredible time savers, and not only time savers, impactful.
Yes.
So where do we go from here then?
I mean, where do we go from here? Let's talk about the valuation argument before we get to AI. So you're going to hear something different from me. Someone who's been a fundamental analyst for 30 years. Okay. For me, I always looked at why didn't I own Microsoft at 80 times earnings? Why didn't I own Apple at 70 times earnings? Why didn't I own Netflix at 120
Amazon.
Times earnings? Yeah. 10, 15, Amazon. Why didn't I own these? Instead of saying, look at the PE, it's so expensive, it's never going to grow into it. So for me, I always check my ego at the door because whenever I think I'm the best in the world, it slaps me in the face. That's why I love doing what I'm doing, right? It's kind of like golf. You get a 59, you get a charge.
My wife does that. As soon as I come in saying, hey, honey, things are great, smack.
Things are great. I'm always questioning. I'm like, holy shit. Especially when I recommend a new stock and everyone's like, that's a great pick. I'm like, shit. Oh, no. So I'd rather people doubt you. But when it comes to valuations, we're so used to looking at PEs. I'm going to tell you right now, on market right now, 22 times forward earnings is cheaper than it was pretty much the past 3-4 years. Because if you look back, we were growing around 8%, right? And you have to look at the growth in the PE, right? Because you could be trading at 10 PE and be super expensive if you're not growing earnings at all, right? And you could be cheap if your PE is 30 and you're growing earnings by 25, 30%, which you're seeing out of NVIDIA, right? So, you know, it doesn't mean it's expensive simply based on a PE. You have to look at growth. And we're growing and expected to grow double digits. I mean, not just double digits, like 11, 12% we're expected to grow, which is very, very high compared to the past, which nobody talks about. They just say, hey, 22 PE is much higher than a 10-year average of 20, 19.9. Mm-hmm. So we're trading at, you know, an exceptional premium to the market, but we're growing a lot faster. right? So not all areas, but if you look at the growth markets, that's why. So what did I get wrong in Netflix? With Netflix, it was, okay, I'm looking, comparing it to traditional cable companies, and I didn't realize that instead of comparing Netflix to individual cable companies, Comcast, whatever, Charter, every single cable company was trying to be like Netflix. Netflix controlled the market. Their total addressable market was about 10 times the size of the rest of the cable companies. And that's what people miss with Palantir. So Palantir, we've been recommending since it's $12. Okay, you could say, oh, it came down from whatever it was, 180, it's 155 right now. We said, look, you're looking at the wrong metrics. The price to sales is 200 times the PE through the roof. We heard that at 10, 30, 80, 120, 150. We heard the same argument, the stock went higher. So instead of saying the same thing, what are we getting wrong? What you're getting wrong is Palantir is one of the only companies in the world from day one. They could, it's the pure play AI that they can come to any single company S&P 500 and immediately you're going to see fantastic results. And you saw that every company in the defense sector that they work with, the oil companies, you have CEO of major oil companies coming on stage with them saying the productivity, what we've seen with this company and what they're doing for us is incredible. So instead of looking at price to sales or PE, you have to look at the total addressable market. Because the total addressable market is $1 trillion for this company. It's not defense and it's not just oil. It's any company who wants to use AI services. These guys have the holy grail right now, right? So I know you could get it through, you know, some of the bigger companies through cloud and you know, AI services and Copilot and Gemini and all that stuff. I'm not even talking about that. This is a company that comes in that works with you completely and does everything for you. And you're seeing, I mean, the massive amount of clients that they're signing up, the margins that they're generating, the massive growth that they're seeing, it continues. As long as you're going to see that growth, you're going to see Palantir shares go higher. Yes, they pull back a little bit, but still, this is a name that we had for a long time. My point here is when you're looking at valuations, you can't just look at a simple PE because it doesn't work. That's coming from someone that's tracked this stuff all my life and knows everything about balance sheets, every single thing, income statements. I've been studying for 30 years. It's different when you're seeing growth. The market for the last 12, 15 years, they want to see growth. They want to see the hope for growth. If you're wondering why Tesla trades at such a crazy valuation, why does Ford and GM trade at a low valuation? Because they're talking about, should I still sell EVs? I don't know. We're seeing a decline. And they're talking about robots and robo-taxis.
Yeah.
Right? Disney knows this is a company I hated for a long time because they can't really compete on the same level as streaming and they're competing against bigger players. But as soon as they started making announcements of parks that are open up in the Middle East, they should open up 100 parks. That's their growth model. Right. So when you have this growth model that people could see, even if it's 5 years, 10 years out, that's what drives the stock price higher. You know, when you look at valuations and stuff, some of them are expensive, but you're looking at AI, you're looking at crypto with this administration, 100% pro crypto. I'm talking about things that are coming out on the equity side that are going to be very interesting and disruptive technologies. There's a lot of areas for growth and it's probably going to continue because rates are going lower next year, which everybody knows.
Well, what about switching over then to the thought of private businesses, private equity. So private equity is doing, I think I told you this, that I was down at an event in Miami. I don't usually go to a lot of events, but I was at this one, a couple of the guys that I know, Meb Faber, a few other ones, Ritholtz and Josh Brown, they're all down there. They're all down mm-hmm. over at this event. Nice. And yeah. I said, you know what? It's in Miami, I'm going. And so I go to this cocktail party and I don't know if I had a sign on my back. I don't know what was going on, but all these guys coming up to me unsolicited. You know, you got to be in private equity. Got to get your clients in private equity. You know, what are you doing about private equity? I'm like, what, where, why is everybody saying this to me? Is it a private equity conference? I don't understand what's happening. And it's kind of weird. And now private equity is trying to get their shoe into, 401ks, trying to get it, you know, make it so it's like, oh, no big deal. You just have to hold your money. I can tell you, I got private equity for clients that we adopted. It's a pain in the ass. And the question is, are they ever going to come out now? Yes, some of them will come out with great returns over the long haul, but the liquidity is non-existent. The capital call requirements and things like that are something you need to contend with. Taxation issues, long-term nature of getting your K-1s in. I just got a K-1 literally today. What are we in? We're in September. I got a K-1 from one of the companies today. Mm-hmm. So that means you can't do your taxes. You can't complete your taxes.
Yeah.
And then the valuation, you know, whatever they feel like it's worth. Now, you got companies like in the AI technology area, Anthropic. Anthropic, I think their valuation tripled in the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean, Are you agreeing with me like it's a no big deal agreement? Or are you agreeing with me like, okay, we'll talk about it? Well, I mean,
There's a lot of stuff you said there. First of all, when it comes to private equity, I would say 98% of retail investors that invest in private equity are going to lose their money. Because they don't understand the deal structure. Sometimes I don't understand the deal structure, and I do this for a living. Okay, I'm talking about deal structure where, you know, if you're looking even at SPACs, like they didn't have to disclose warrants. You don't even know what's under the hood. You don't know when they're able to sell. So what they do is they buy these companies through SPACs and they have to find a really cool company and say, okay, let's find a cool company that's growing. Okay, that the value of that company is $400 million. By the time it goes through the SPAC process and you transfer everything through the shell company, you change the name or whatever, that valuation is like $2 billion. And what happens once you announce that merger is you have these pipe investors. And now you're saying, okay, I want to raise more money for this. Okay, we'll give you shares at $1. We'll give you shares at $2, $2.50 with warrants, all this. So you have this massive amount. They're pumping it to the public market saying this is the greatest thing ever, right? Just like Virgin Galactic. It's the greatest. Everyone's going to space. The whole world's going to space, right? Yeah. These guys cash out him. What was it? Chamath. And I'll say this.
Chamath Palihapitiya. Yeah, Palihapitiya. Branson.
And Branson, $300 million each they made off of that. That stock is what, $2, $3 now? Right? They cashed in at what, $25, $30?
I made a lot of money on it too, but yes, continue.
Yeah, but I'm just saying most retail investors got annihilated because they don't know how these deals are structured. They're just like, hey, this is an AI company that's growing. Okay, well, what's the valuation of it? All right, is it $300 million or if it's $10 billion? Because it's worth like maybe a billion. So if I get in $300 million, that's good. That's the Peter Thiel stuff. You know, so when I'm looking at that, looking at these deals, that's one part of the deal where if you're going to open up this market to 401ks, you want to do it where they could track the performance. So if BlackRock creates an ETF of private investments, then you could see it crash or go down. At least, you know, because a lot of these deals, and I get into these deals a lot, and again, I've made a lot of mistakes, and now I understand exactly what I want and what I need when I'm helping these companies raise money. Anthropic's a different story. This is one of the fastest growing startups that I've ever seen, right? I mean, the biggest winner here is Amazon by far. Amazon invested in this company very early, $8 billion, 33% stake. Not only is Amazon—
Is that what they have, 33%?
Yeah, wow. 33% they have, 33%. So, nice. So not only is that $8 billion worth more than $60 billion, but now you have Amazon generating billions in revenue since Anthropic is running its massive models through AWS. They're using the Amazon's chips to power it. But when you look at Anthropic, you could see if you look on like the large language model list, and it's pretty much unbiased because you have coders and they have which ones are the best services. And if you look on, you know, this particular name, you don't see them on a lot of lists like the best for math or tool use, affordability, speed. But what are they the best at is you're looking at a company that is going all in on agentic AI. And when you look at agentic AI, that is the future of AI. That's just basically digital employees. That's how you have to think about
that. Let's explain that. Tell us what the word means, because I think most people haven't heard that. When I say most people, me, haven't heard that phrase before. I don't know why.
So agentic coding, right?
How do you spell it?
A-G-E-N-T-I-C. So this is agentic coding. So this is AI agents. And this is what the whole, all the biggest companies in the world are doing,
Agentic. Agents,
but it's called agentic coding, right? So that's what they're the best at. So basically these are tools, they'll interact with tools that help, you know, read files, write code, run commands, they'll access databases, they'll gather all this information, and then they'll execute actions, which you actually did on my podcast, when you booked a trip basically and said, look how easy this is, and you did it off the fly, it wasn't even planned, right? So not only do they have these mechanisms for feedback and they can adapt to things, but that's what makes them learn from their mistakes and get better and better and better, making them the perfect digital worker, which means now you're seeing them replace in so many different industries. Where, why is that huge? Because now these things work 24 hours. You don't have to worry about paying them unemployment. You don't have to worry about paying their benefits, 401ks or anything, right?
And no drama.
So if you look at how big this market is, and that's what they specialize in, you know, it's a reason why the list of investors that came into the Series F round, which was huge, right? What was it? I think it was $13 billion or something for $180 billion valuation. Fidelity, Lightspeed Venture, and also BlackRock, Blackstone, Goldman, Jane Street, Ontario Teachers Plan. I mean, you're getting these guys, you know, get pension funds investing in it. T. Rowe Price, TPG. I mean, Qatar Investment Authority. These are real players generating billions of dollars, knowing that this is the future of AI. It's not just large language models. This is the next step for AI, that it's just on the surface right now. We're probably in first, second inning, that you're going to see the biggest companies in the world. They're going to be using all these bots to do a lot of the jobs of employees. And that's pretty much here. That's why you're seeing a lot of layoffs. It's pretty crazy. But they deserve that valuation.
I read some really interesting articles. One was from Goldman. There's a couple of the research players out there that did this also, talking about what jobs are not going to be needed, the highest probability of jobs that would be out of business in X number of years due to the advent of AI. And you have things like, you know, for example, if there is such a job as this, a proofreader. Like, what do you need that for anymore? right? It's the equivalent of what you need a receptionist for.
I'll make it simple. Anything that's non-blue collar is at risk.
Which is interesting because everybody always used to fear the blue collar job loss on all the time. Yeah. That's all it was all about. Oh my God, technology is going to replace this, the efficiencies.
Plumbers, electricians, you can't replace that. You need professionals to do that and they're going to be able to charge a fortune.
But that was something that for years was a problem. It's kind of fascinating actually that the Trump administration is so focused on manufacturing slash cars slash blue collar, right? That's what they're really, well, because of course that's a big amount of votes there. But it's so fascinating that they haven't even had the intellectual honesty, to be honest with you, to talk about, what about the white collar jobs? Like, what's going on there? Nobody wants to talk about it.
And those beginning jobs, even for lawyers or paralegals and stuff like that, like when you come out of college, right? That's what's killing it because those jobs, they don't really need to hire anyone for that. And that's, for kids right now, you had the greatest opportunity of your life. I mean, you hear everyone telling you how terrible things are, but even you had OpenAI, right? Came out, the CEO came out. He said something interesting. He's doing a big run on podcasts and stuff like that. So, and he came out and said, this is the first time in history that you'll be able to have a $1 billion business run by one employee. I thought that was fascinating.
Love that.
I love that, right? Because but that's the opportunity to learn AI. Because I have two kids. One's looking at colleges now. The other one's 14, is a freshman in high school. Two daughters, and I'm pushing them all in on AI. Not that it makes you cheat, but the research that's available at your fingertips for AI is unbelievable to ask it questions. And I mean, you can take a picture of something and say, analyze this on a fifth grade level, on an 11th grade level, and it gives you the whole summary in 2 seconds. And yeah, it really is incredible what AI is doing. But you have to be into AI if you're young, if you're in college, because that's the future and you're going to make a fortune. Even if you're working, just learn it. If you find a way to improve productivity, your boss is going to pay you more money. Right? Yeah, well, so listen, don't just sit there and don't embrace it.
And just for us mere humans, looking at AI as a, I don't want to call a total substitute for search, but an easier, more methodical way. For example, let's bring up my AI, shall we? Here we go. Here he comes.
Hey again, Andrew.
Hey, tell me about Frank Curzio, the newsletter writer. Tell me a little bit about him.
Frank Curzio, the mastermind behind Curzio Research, is a well-known newsletter writer who focuses on providing in-depth market analysis and investment education. He made his mark with the Curzio Research Advisory, a large-cap investment advisory service. With a history steeped in Wall Street experience, Frank and his team aim to empower individual investors.
All right, stop. You like that?
No, don't stop it.
Hey, hold on, I got more. Tell me about something. Tell me something. Whose podcast is better, Andrew Horowitz's or Frank Curzio's?
Andrew Horowitz and Frank Curzio both host popular financial podcasts. Horowitz's podcast delves into investment strategies and market analysis, while Curzio's Wall Street Unplugged often features industry experts and unique investment insights. It's tough to declare a winner since it really depends on your style and preference. If you're after disciplined investing advice, Andrew's might be your jam. But for market-moving news, Frank's podcast could be the way to go.
That is awesome. That was awesome.
That was just on the fly.
I'm going to pull that out as a clip.
That was totally on the fly, by the way. No, I didn't plan that. I literally did not plan that. No, I just took my phone. I put it up to the microphone here, and I just started asking away.
Which AI is it?
So that is Copilot. That's the Copilot mobile app.
Yeah. Benioff should spend less time criticizing Copilot and worry about his stock, by the way.
Speaking of which, let's get into that. Let's get into Salesforce, because one of the most beloved stocks of all time by your old pal, Jim Cramer, who brings Benioff anytime he wants to be on the Mad Money show. And I don't think there's been a time that I recall that Cramer wasn't in love with him. Salesforce recently put out some earnings, and it was okay, but there was some disappointment in there, particularly around the AI strategy.
Yeah, listen, CRMs are severely threatened by AI. And this is something we talked about for a while. I mean, you hear me talk bullish about the market conditions overall, but we're bearish on a lot of names. Chipotle was another name that we've been bearish on for over a year and a half. Disney, we were very bearish on for a long time, for like 4 or 5 years. Listen, some of them we get right, some of them we get wrong. But Salesforce, we're very bearish on because, they talk a big game. But when it comes to CRM systems, and if anyone has a business over 3 million, they know how important that is. You can't just use one system, right? You have to use a bunch of different systems. It's just some of them are good in other areas, credit card processing, just labeling, going over marketing strategies and stuff like that, reading headlines, right? Now with AI, you could build, you could tailor it to yourself, and it's a lot cheaper. So it threatens all these companies. And Benioff was out there saying, hey, we're ahead of this. We're all AI. We're going, but it's not showing up in the results. So when you're a CEO and you overpromise and underdeliver, you piss off your investors, right? And your biggest investors. And that's what they've been doing. So now you're looking at a company and saying, okay, I looked at these numbers and yes, it looks very, very good and that you're growing and everything looks awesome. But when you look specifically at the AI component, you're not seeing that growth. They're going to say it's up 120%. Okay. And that seems like great growth. It's up 120%. I get it, right? That's huge growth. But when you really look at the details here, they come out with a metric and there's KPIs. It's not all the same KPIs for all companies, as you know. Sometimes it could be same store sales. Sometimes it could be average revenue per user. You know, for this company, it's CRPO. It's current remaining performance obligation, right? So when you, that number rose 11% to 29.4 billion. I'm not going to throw too many numbers at you, but just know AI, which grew 120%, is only 1.2 billion of that. And it from last quarter, it grew 11% year over year, but it did not grow quarter over quarter. And when you look at that, that tells investors and tells the street saying, okay, this AI is supposed to be a huge growth component. You're seeing it with a lot of companies, whether it's Marvel, I know they report great earnings, Smith Micro, you have Dell, you know, you see this component, IBM, that AI getting bigger and bigger piece of the chunk. This should be growing and it's not growing. And this is a severe threat to this business model.
But there's another issue.
So
the amount of money that they have under their model also incorporates how much money is coming in from various contracts they have, right? The seats.
Yep, exactly.
Well, also they increase the price. I've been with Salesforce for 15 years, whatever it is. This is the first time I recall, maybe a second, but the first time I recall in a very, very long time, they actually increased my price. Small amount, but like 10%. You take that into the equation, that means basically they're not growing.
Yeah, and that's the negative thesis on Disney. Right now, their earnings are good, but it's because they're cutting content. So you're cutting content, which is worse for the consumer. You're throwing commercials all over it, and you're raising prices. What do you think is going to happen to your subscriber base? You know, same here. You know, when you're not seeing the benefits and you're raising prices, you're going to lose customers. But I'm not telling you to short it here. This is a company that we said avoid at all costs, but don't short. I mean, I need to see a couple more quarters to see if they get this right. But it's trading below a market multiple of 20 times, which is very cheap for a tech company. And they just announced another $20 billion buyback, which increases it to $50 billion. Now, that might be a big number to you. I'm just saying that's 20% of the market cap. That's a massive number that you're buying back. Plus, it's a Dow component. So, you know, money's automatically going to flow into Dow companies and stuff like that. But when you look at this company where it is, I wouldn't tell you to short it here, but I don't see the catalyst of why you would buy the stock. I need to see that as the CEO. And instead, the CEO is criticizing Copilot and Microsoft and everybody else. He's got to stop overpromising and underdelivering because right now he lost all credibility.
Well, we're talking with the mastermind, Frank Curzio.
Love it.
So funny. The mastermind, Frank Curzio. I'll just call you M&M Curzio, okay? Small caps. Let's get into that. Small caps have been lagging, right? Small caps have been on the lowest of all low lists for a while. There's been discussion about like 70% of the small caps on the Russell 2000 are basically defunct companies to a degree, and you know, nobody wants them. And risk on has been there, but it's been really all the money's been pouring into large cap. There's been some moments of, oh, look at that, you know, but small caps are still not near their all-time high yet. You're very bullish on them. Is there a specific sector, micro, smalls, what? What are we talking about?
Just small caps. And I wouldn't buy the Russell 2000 here, but when have you seen a market? You're a student of this market like I am for a very long time, for decades. Usually when you see a bull market, which we've seen a raging bull market since the credit crisis, basically, right? With a few bumps in a row, 2017, the COVID, but overall. And if you look at that time frame, what happens in bull markets? Usually they say the crappy companies go much, much higher. They don't say that. That's usually what happens, right? So usually small caps outperform when you see the markets go higher, and they underperform it during defensive times because people don't want to take on risk. It's really weird to see over this period, especially over the past 3-4 years since COVID, that small caps have significantly underperformed. And maybe a lot of it has to do with, you know, the major, you know, the Mag 7 companies, especially the hyperscalers that just have blowout margins and massive growth across. I don't know if you've seen the report. They have like 7 divisions and every one of them are growing 25% plus. It's remarkable when you look at some of these companies. But small caps now, especially with America, more money coming into America, more manufacturing jobs coming into America. These are companies that don't have that much exposure overseas, but just even in the infrastructure market, I love the oil market right now. I know that OPEC, you know, may cut production again, but oil prices at 60. If we see lower interest rates, you're going to see more building. Plus, if you're looking at the international markets, they're on fire right now. Okay, they've been outperforming the markets because they've all, almost every single market, I'd say 95% of them, have been cutting rates all year. We're the only, like, you know, country that hasn't been cutting rates yet, right? So, you know, and that's going to lead to more construction. But just bringing up the prices in certain things where there are some small caps that have a little exposure overseas. So it's not the Russell 2000 I would tell you to buy, but the names that I'm seeing within small caps within those industries, one name is called DigiPower, which owns 200 megawatts of power. Okay. Right now on the market for Bitcoin mining, that goes for $1 million a megawatt, right? So that's 200 million right there. And they own it. They don't lease it. They own this, right? They own it. They went through the policies and everything. They've owned it for like 6-7 years and they're a Bitcoin miner, but they're transitioning into data services. And when you transition, that's tier three. So tier one is Bitcoin mining. When you transition, the value of those megawatts go from about 1 million to 10 to 15 million. And that's, I don't know if you saw the power lately. I don't know if you know electricity prices are skyrocketing. It's why solar is probably a great bet. It's the first time it's going to be economical forever because prices are going, there's not enough energy to power AI. There's not enough energy out there. That's why if you look at the hyperscalers, they're buying stuff 20 years out that's not even going to be available 5 years, like Three Mile Island. They're buying stuff like, what is it, Oklo, which has no revenue, not a proven strategy, not a proven technology, no revenue. That's trading at a $9 billion valuation. Okay, because they have SMRs, which is basically, you know, like these small nuclear reactors that transfer, you could bring them back and forth, right? That are mobile. But if you're looking at DGXX with the power that they own, you know, that's a great name too that I love right now, trading at like $2. That's a name I'm invested in personally. But that, and I'm going to hold it long term because they're transitioning to tier three right now. So those assets, and you talk about companies trading under $100 million market cap. So there's a lot of value in small caps that I'm seeing and lots of ideas that I really like that I haven't seen pretty much over the past 5-7 years. And we've been doing very, very well in our small cap newsletter, our AI newsletter, focusing on these names, just names that are up 700% for us. But, you know, we're able to pick them apart because they're lumped in with all the small caps and people really don't like small caps. But we have a market with very powerful tailwinds that I mentioned before. That should be really good for a lot of small caps, but you have to analyze them. You can't just throw a dart and you know, it's a bull market, I'm going to make money. You really have to do the research on it. That's what we do, the homework on it.
Good stuff. Frank Curzio, always a pleasure to have you on. And I look forward to your great event, although I won't be there. I'm sure it'll be great. And the next time you're on as well. Thanks for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, man. Love you, bro.
Thanks. See you soon. Well, that's what we have there, and that was a great show because it's fast-moving, it's hard-hitting, it's information overload, fast-talking. I even speed up dramatically when Frank is on the show. I know it, I feel it, and I got to re-listen because I know that I get all ramped and amped when Frank's there. So talked about a lot of things all the way from IBM and Marvell and Palantir and AMD. We talked about the economics, the Fed, and we talked about valuations. We talked about Salesforce and what's going on there. We also talked about false market values. And of course, the mastermind through AI, Frank Curzio, some things that you don't find everywhere. So thanks for joining me this week. Next week coming up, I believe is, I think we have Peter Schiff scheduled for next week, if my memory serves me correctly. But nonetheless, a lot going to happen over the next few weeks with the topsy-turvy decisions that will be made over tariffs and the results, the after effect of the results of the recent economic numbers we saw and the jobs number. And, of course, all that is gearing up to, I think it's on the 16th, we have the Fed decision on rates. So a lot of things happening. No shortness of excitement here. Join me next week. We'll talk more about it. Thanks so much. See you soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.